Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Hi, this is Pat McDonald, your host for Vermont Viewpoint. Rick Zungari is not in studio today, and here I am. I've got two guests today, and I'm going to start with the second guest first because he'll be on at 10 o'clock. That's Doug Hoffer, Vermont Auditor of Accounts, and wait till you hear what we're going to talk about. One of them's got my attention for sure. My second guest, who is in studio with me, is Lauren Hibbert, who is Director of the Office of Professional Regulations. I'm sure some of you may not have heard of the Office of Regulations, OPR as we call it. So, Lauren, welcome.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning.
I really appreciate being able to come talk to you about the Office of Professional Regulation and the new legislation around the Nurse Licensure Compact.
Yep, which is what we're going to, I'll tell you a little history. I do a blog with Ben Kinsley, and I tried to talk about this bill, Do you know what the act number is? So I just went blank.
I believe it's
62 or something?
68,
I think. 68. Well, anyway, I started to talk about that, and it just went on forever. A lot of details. So I thought I better bring on the expert, which is why Lauren's here. But first, Lauren, could you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. I've worked at the Office of Professional Regulation for 11 years. I began as a prosecutor in 2011 after moving back home from New York City. I then was chief prosecutor in our enforcement unit and then general counsel and now have been director for coming on 3 years.
That's great. And Chris Winters was the OPR director before you, correct?
He was. There was an interim director Colin Benjamin.
Yeah, because Chris is now deputy secretary of the Secretary of State's office.
That's
with Jim
correct.
Condos. Great group you have over there.
I know.
There.
I'm so fortunate. I get to work with them.
Nice group. So let's just talk a little bit about OPR. And I have to tell you, as a legislator, you probably have sensed this in the 11 years. When the OPR bill comes in, everybody goes, ugh, because it is very detailed. It's necessary, but very detailed and many, many pages. And I think the legislature, House of Ops, takes about, at least a week or two to get through that bill. So it's sort of it's OPR time.
Absolutely.
But let's talk about the kind of things you do license. And I think every one of us must interact with somebody you've licensed in your daily work.
Sure. So first and foremost, OPR is an umbrella agency. We're responsible for 49 different professions at this point. So really a wide spectrum of regulatory oversight over occupations in the state of Vermont. Our first and primary focus is public protection. What that means is we set the licensing standards for those professions, and then when somebody steps out of bounds and commits unprofessional conduct, we investigate those cases, prosecute those cases, and put conditions or restrictions on somebody's license. So examples of how you would encounter a licensee could be everything from cutting your hair to getting a tattoo to buying a house to seeing your dentist to taking your cat to a vet. It's really quite a wide spectrum of responsibility that the office has. We do our work with the help of appointees, either by the governor, if it's a board. So in this case, the Board of Nursing has appointees from the governor's office. But we also have advisor professions for our smaller professions that just provide advice directly to me to help with the regulatory oversight. And what that means is the statutes and rules, and that all leads up into that OPR bill that you're referring to, Pat.
Sorry.
No, it's totally fine. We always have an annual bill because there's always work to be done. Scopes of practices modulate and change. The way that we want to oversee a profession changes some bit. And so we need to make modifications. So that's why you get that bill. Yeah. And it is always a hefty one.
And I think it's very – I remember some groups coming in really wanting to be licensed because it adds to their professionalism. It helps them – get jobs because people want to know if you're licensed. Because I remember a couple of groups that came into GovOps
really saying, you know, we want to be licensed because it helps them, correct?
That is correct. And the state does have a really wonderful process called the Sunrise Review Process, where the office reviews whether or not somebody should be regulated. And really the threshold question is, does the profession need to be regulated to protect the public? Not just because the profession wants to be regulated, mm-hmm. but does the public need this profession to be regulated? And the background philosophy behind that is really the government should only intrude into an occupation if it's absolutely necessary, because any time that the government starts to regulate something, there's some red tape created, right?
Right.
So we want to minimize red tape. We want to minimize sort of the obstacles to getting into the profession, because the primary goal should be everyone should get into occupations as quickly and smoothly as possible.
Right.
And licensure is always the last step for our licensees. You know, people go to college for many years or apprenticeship programs, training programs, and then they give us proof of their education, and we're the last step that gives them the authorization to get into the workforce. Yeah. So that Sunrise Review process really is it necessary to have the government involved in whether or not you should be working?
Yeah. Now, you deal a lot with the medical profession, except for physicians who are under Dave Herlihy's auspices. He's the executive director for
the Board of Medical Practice. Yes, so we do, in our shop, we have osteopathic physicians, but the allopathic physicians are over in the medical practice board.
Right, under the health department, which kind of makes sense.
I think it does have some benefits for them,
yeah.
Although I have to say we work very closely with the Department of Health as well,
yeah.
Because of the wide variety of occupations that we regulate, and particularly during COVID, we've worked very closely with the Department of Health.
Well, this is a good slide into our discussion today, and I'm so glad you're here. As you mentioned, I had tried to do this bill on air one day, and it didn't go well. And if I had picked up my piece of paper, the bill number is S-48, and it's Act 64, and it's called the Multi-State Nursing Licensure Compact, the Cost and Benefits for Vermont. And I think we all know there's a big shortage of nurses here in Vermont and elsewhere, and so I have a lot of questions about this, and there's a big shortage of everything everywhere. Summer in Maine, and there are signs for help wanted. And when we ride back to Vermont, you see signs, will train, help wanted. But nursing is certainly critical, especially for our nursing homes and people that need 24/7 care. I know home health and hospice has trouble finding nurses to go to people's homes. There's work to be had out there, folks, if you're interested.
Yes, it's in every sector of the health industry, healthcare facility, every type is really struggling to find and retain nurses. And this bill, S-48, really the intent was to help. It's not going to be the panacea. It's not going to solve this problem, but it is a tool in the toolbox to try and maintain and retain nurses in the state of Vermont.
Yeah. Could you give us a little background? I've got to go for break in just a minute, but if you could give us a background, because this is sort of the updated version of an original bill that was passed a while ago.
Sure. So right now there's, you know, almost 26,000 nurses licensed in Vermont, and the office and the Board of Nursing have been reviewing the Nurse Compact for a long time. I think since its inception in the late 1990s, when the National State Board of Nursing started to think about a compact. And the first iteration of the compact was adopted in 2000 by five states. And at that point, it wasn't prudent for Vermont to join the compact, but we certainly were monitoring it and looking at it. And then we started thinking seriously about whether or not we should adopt it about 4 or 5 years ago.
Yeah. So it passed successfully last year. Governor Scott signed it into law. So we are officially a part of it, although it doesn't take effect until 2022, right? 2022.
That's correct. February of 2022.
Yeah. Could you give us kind of the high level overview, the main provisions of the compact for folks?
Sure. It's such a complicated bill, and
yes.
I don't I think it's totally foreseeable that you had trouble explaining it, because it really is. It's an interstate compact, which means it's a contract that our state is entering into with other states. And for people who don't have familiarity with interstate compacts, we have them all the time. Mm-hmm. Our driver's license is an interstate compact. So if you have a license, if you have a driver's license in Vermont, you're free to drive in Connecticut and in Maine as you're driving over to your vacation home. And you really can travel throughout the United States with your Vermont license without any problem. And the nurse compact is a similar concept, a little bit different, obviously some more guardrails than the driver's license compact. But it allows somebody who has an interstate compact license for nursing to practice in any of the other states that also have the compact. So when Vermont joined the compact, we were saying, starting February 1st of 2022, that if you're licensed in another state and you have a compact license in that state, say Connecticut or Maine, then you can come into Vermont and work without getting a license in Vermont.
That's great.
And so that really improves mobility throughout the states.
Awesome. Lauren, you were just in the middle of talking about some of the key points in this compact. If you could continue on.
Sure. So as I was discussing, the main purpose of the compact is to allow nurses to travel in between states seamlessly if they hold a compact license. So with that, there's some parameters around, minimum requirements so that states can feel really comfortable. So, for instance, background checks are required, which up to this point, we have not had criminal background checks for nurses in the state of Vermont. So this is a huge policy shift that we're working through. But also other guardrails, no participation in a rehabilitation program. And so there are people who are not eligible for a compact license, and there will be always a single state license. The main purpose is really to ensure that the nurses that are coming into our state or leaving our state to go work in another compact state are fit to practice in those states.
Are these nurses what we would call traveling nurses? Are they the same? Or are they different?
Some of them are traveling nurses. Some of them are just, we're a small state.
Yeah.
So we have people who live in New Hampshire and work in Vermont, or similarly live in Vermont and work in New Hampshire.
Right. Certainly down by Dartmouth, they may even live in New York, some of them.
That's correct. Yeah. That's correct. And we do have many healthcare professionals who cross the lake every day to work at UVM. So
That's right.
There's a lot of, sometimes people think of this as a traveler bill. I don't think that it would only serve travelers. Vermont does rely on traveling nurses, as does every other state in the nation because of the health worker.
Most times I've ever met a traveling nurse has been operating equipment. The equipment that you go to the hospital for a test, that's where I've met the traveling nurses. But the object is to have uniformity in their training so they can fit in and treat you the same as perhaps anybody here from Vermont. Can I ask you a question? If I'm a nurse and I don't want to travel, I don't have to travel.
That is correct.
I can do you mentioned a single state license.
That is correct. So we'll always have a single state license. Along with the compact. And we are anticipating that most nurses, even nurses in Vermont who never intend to leave Vermont, may opt to get the compact license because of the future possibilities that it could give them. But we will have a single state license so that people who are in active recovery from a drug and alcohol addiction or have a criminal conviction on their background, but they've rehabilitated those types of things would preclude them from a compact license, but Vermont still would want to license them. Mm-hmm. We have a really strong interest in helping people rehabilitate from drug and alcohol addictions, but also allowing people who have criminal backgrounds obtain licensure.
So let's just talk on, I know on this bill it said the cost and the benefits, and let's just focus on, let's do the cost first, because that's the part that really confused me in the bill about how much it's going to cost us to participate it sounded like there were costs, and I don't know whether the benefits outweigh the costs, or I couldn't quite get a handle on that. Could you talk a little bit about what this is going to cost? I don't know who us is, us the taxpayers, us the hospital, who knows?
Sure. So, yes, the costs were heavily discussed in the legislative process. And really the cost is, well, first let me back up. So the Office of Professional Regulation does not receive any general fund money, which means it doesn't receive any taxpayer funds. We're solely supported by our licensees' fees to us. So application fees, renewal fees that come every 2 years. So we don't receive any general fund money. But what the compact is going to do is when a current state, before the compact, when a traveling nurse came on assignment in Vermont, he or she would get a license in Vermont, which would mean we would receive their fees.
Right.
But what's going to happen is now they'll be able to come into Vermont and work here without paying licensure fees for a period of time until they choose to change their residence. And hopefully some of them will do that. But what that will mean is we'll have a reduction in our licensing fees in the nursing board special fund.
So how will you be able to make that up? Because I'm sure it's pretty tight.
Yeah, no, we do run a very tight budget because any excess is charging Vermonters more money than they should be charged as they're trying to get into the workforce. So we do run a very tight budget. We're have a report back to the legislature on the impacts of implementing the compact. That's due, I think, in 2024, when we start to see how it all trickles out and what the actual effect is. Okay. And we will obviously try and draw down costs in every way that we can before we ask for a fee increase.
So, Lauren, hold on. We have Fred from Newberry on the phone. Fred?
Morning.
Good morning. Welcome.
Hey, let's see here. What constitutes a criminal background check, and how long does it take? I had a criminal background check in New Hampshire, and it took 15 minutes.
Well, ask Lauren that. He's wanting to know how long it takes to do a criminal background check and what it's comprised of.
Sure. So this is an FBI fingerprint-supported criminal background check. I think they're taking about 4 weeks, and they're done through VCIC with the Department of Public Safety.
Yeah. Did you have a background check for buying a gun, Fred? Just because I had, and that took about 10 minutes, 5 minutes.
Yeah, it took about, it was for buying a gun.
Yeah, I think that's the one Lauren's talking about is much more in depth because, you're dealing with patients of all ages and want to make sure that there aren't any criminal issues to deal with. So thank you for your call. We appreciate you calling in. Okay, so Lauren, sorry. Could you want to continue on with our discussion?
Sure. So we were on costs. So the other cost is to be part of the compact, it's $6,000 per year, which is a very small part of the Board of Nursing's budget. So really the biggest cost is this reduction in licensure fees and something that the office was very concerned about, as you can anticipate. And one of the reasons why we, before we started to support the compact, we really engaged with the nursing community in the state of Vermont. And we sent out a survey in 2019 to all of the licensees in Vermont to explain the financial ramifications and the policy objectives of the compact.
Now, who pays for travel for these folks? Car travel, plane travel, maybe, depending on where they're asked to go, and hotels? Food, who pays for that? Does the compact?
No. The compact does not. People who are quote unquote traveling nurses are engaged with an agency, and the agency pays for that type of travel and their expenses.
So that's why that wasn't in the bill, because I'm like, who's paying for this?
Yeah.
Because I don't think I'd care to hop down to South Carolina to, if I had to pay for those expenses myself.
Yeah, no, it's part of the traveler. Right. The traveling nurse is engaged with a traveling nurse
party.
Agency, mm-hmm. and then the institution has a contract with that agency. But again, this bill doesn't just improve logistics for traveling nurses. And repeatedly throughout the testimony in front of the legislature, you know, the hospital association and the nursing home association really stress that they do not want to continue using travelers. It's a very expensive model for them.
Yeah.
It's not their preference. No. It's really because of this nursing shortage. And when we really dug in with our survey, what we found was the majority of Vermont licensees do support the compact. And particularly new graduates of Vermont's nursing programs, of which we have many really fine nursing mm-hmm. programs in the state of Vermont.
We do.
We're fortunate. They all had a strong preference for adoption of the compact.
Do you think, or because people are going to start being able to apply pretty soon, right? Do you think this could be a recruitment tool to give you give people the opportunity not only be a nurse in your backyard, but maybe travel to somewhere exotic or something just to travel?
I think it could be. You know, it's probably not surprising to you that it's the beginning of the career and the end of the career where people are really interested in traveling, you know, before they settle down and have a family.
Yep.
And as they're
maturing.
Yes.
Thank you.
And so, you know, I do think that there are people that will find the compact has some benefit to their life. I will say that the compact and compacts in general in the nation are really supported by the Department of Defense. And one of the reasons is that the concept of the – I hate the term, actually, but it's called the trailing military spouse. So the wife or husband of a military service member, we know that those folks – typically have professional licenses, and military families move more frequently than other than other families in the nation. Typically, military families move 7 to 8 times in the course of their professional career. And if you're a nurse, that means you're getting 7 or 8 different, distinct licenses. And so the DOD really supports the Nurse Compact.
I was just thinking, I was Commissioner of Personnel, as we were discussing before, and we would have a heck of a time when a couple would come into Vermont. We have a job for the husband or wife, but not necessarily for the other spouse. And if they happen to have a license, a nursing license, they could join the compact and be good to go wherever their husband or spouse wound up.
Yes, it really does reduce red tape as people are moving into our state, which is a goal, so that they can just start working the day after they come.
Great. We're going into a hard break now. This is Pat McDonald on Vermont Viewport at WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
Hi, welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. This is Pat McDonald, your host. Rick is not here today, but joining me is Lauren Hibbert, who is the director of the Office of Professional Regulations. We are talking about, let me get this act name right, Act 64, which is the Multi-State Nursing Licensure Compact, and very detailed, as you can tell. Lauren, maybe we can talk about the other side of the coin, the benefits.
Sure. So obviously the most significant benefit is that mobility that you and I've been talking about. But also, as being part of the compact, we have the ability to have where we will have access to a new database of that compact states share that gives us inside information about discipline that may be happening in another state and qualifications. So we have a more in-depth insight into the nurses that are working in our state under the compact license.
Now, who does the training for all these nurses? Does the compact, individual states? I mean, how do you make sure it's uniform?
Sure. So we're very fortunate. The nursing profession is a very uniform profession in terms of education. And there also is a national exam. So everyone who's licensed as a nurse, either as an LPN, which is a licensed practical nurse, or an RN, which is a registered nurse, all need to pass this exam called the NCLEX. And the NCLEX really ensures that everyone's appropriately trained and has the appropriate knowledge. And of course, nursing is a fabulous career because there's a lot of variety in what you can do, and you can change types of nursing that you do, and you can obtain special certifications in, say, emergency department nursing versus obstetrics nursing. So it's really it's a fabulous career because there's a lot of diversity in roles, and some of that happens on the job when you're in when you're hired. Some of that can happen through training that a nurse would have pursued.
How much are folks into telehealth? Because I've had several, because of COVID, I've had several meetings with my doctors over my computer, and I love it. You know why? Because, sorry, doctors, they have to pay attention to you because they're really looking right at you, and people aren't coming in and out of the office, and they're really, it's a great tool, I think.
Yeah, you're not alone. I think a lot of patients appreciate telehealth because it's easier to get to an appointment. You're not spending gas money and time traveling, and you're able to speak to your provider right through your computer, which is phenomenal.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we have had a large growth of telehealth. The compact does help enable telehealth. You know, right now there's if the law is, and I expect it will be, continue to be, that if the patient is in Vermont, the person must be licensed in Vermont. And what the compact would allow would be for telehealth to happen with a provider who's in Connecticut or in New Hampshire without having a Vermont license. But telehealth has really exploded during COVID, and a lot of the licensing restrictions on who can practice here have relaxed during COVID. You know, we worked very closely with the legislature right in March of 2020 to enact some emergency legislation to allow out-of-state professionals to work here and to provide telehealth here. And that really was all hands on deck emergency. Those provisions have continued, and they expire in March of 2022. And our office is also overseeing a work group with, I think we have 55 different stakeholders engaged in talking about the future of telehealth and how the state should proceed with telehealth because it's not going away, because patients like you really enjoy it.
Yeah, I love it.
And it has some benefits for the providers too. So we're really looking at the future of telehealth and what direction the state should take with
it. It's great because I was involved with Central Vermont Home Health and Hospice, which is an amazing organization, and they go to people's homes, and what a great way to check in with them. And they do a lot of that now, but I just think it can expand. And what if, I was just thinking, what if a nurse wants to go to a higher level than what's perhaps covered by the compact? Do they then have to get licensed in their own state with that separate license, like something advanced, some advanced degree?
Sure. So I think you're talking about the advanced practice nurse.
Yes, right.
Which in Vermont has a similar scope and can practice very independently, but they're not equivalent to physicians, but they have a very similar scope. You know, I see an advanced practice nurse for my primary care provider. So that is a separate educational path. You have to be a registered nurse first. So in the state of Vermont, you would be registered as a a registered nurse, and then you would have the advanced practice nurse credentials stacked on top, which is, you know, that's the great thing about being in the nursing profession is you can start as an LNA and then go to school and become an LPN and then go do a little bit more school and become an RN and then do and some additional training and education and become an advanced practice nurse.
Nice.
And so the advanced practice nurse is not part of the compact. The underlying credential of RN, you could have a compact license for that underlying credential, but the compact wouldn't extend to the advanced practice nurse license because there's quite a bit of variation in scopes of practice for advanced practice nurses across the nation. Some in some states they practice completely you know, hand in hand with the physician. In some states like ours, they're far more independent and have, you know, full prescribing rights and all of those things. So there is an APRN compact. It's at the very beginning of its inception. I think there's seven states that are part of it. And certainly it's something we will be watching and seeing whether it's appropriate for Vermont to join.
That's great. That's great. You know, I just realizing that you mentioned discipline before. If a nurse has done something while she's in Maine, is her discipline handled back home here in Vermont or in Maine where the incident occurred?
Sure. So if she's a Vermont compact nurse and she's working in Maine, the discipline can occur either in Maine or it could occur in Vermont. And Maine does not have the ability to take away her Vermont compact license.
But we do.
But we do. Yeah. But what Maine can do, or more importantly from my perspective, what we can do if there's an out-of-state nurse practicing in our state and they engage in unprofessional conduct, we can say you can no longer work in Vermont. Hmm. So we can take away their right to practice here, even if they don't hold a license in our state.
Interesting. I was just also thinking about unions because I know UVM is unionized. I don't know about Central Vermont Medical Center, but how do they fit into this compact, into the discipline, into all of the rulemaking and stuff? Do they weigh in? Are they at the table?
Yes, they are definitely at the table. They were at the table during the legislative process. I think they had, and I don't want to speak for them, but I think they had some concerns about the impact of increased travelers with the implementation and at adaptation of the nurse licensure compact because they saw this as a way to possibly have more travelers coming into the state. They do participate in our rulemaking process. They typically do pay attention to what we're doing in the legislature related to nursing. I think they have a good, strong voice at the table, and I think it's important that their perspective is heard.
Yep, I do too. I'm very supportive of the unions. I think especially in state government when I was commissioner of personnel. I mean, when you have to deal with 8,000 people at the time, that's what we had employed. It's a little easier to deal with a union.
Yes, yes.
Who is responsible for dealing with the 8,000 people. And they did a good job. They do a good job here in Vermont. So I just, the benefits here just are go on forever. I guess what I'd like to talk about, speaking of unions, is their wages and benefits. Are they – because I know traveling nurses make a lot more. That's the rumor. I don't know if that's true, but it. But I understand that over the years they've made some boku bucks. So what happens to the wages and benefits of the people in the compact?
Well, so traveling nurses on paper do look like they make more money per hour. But typically some of those fees go to that third party agency and for the traveling costs and for housing costs.
Yep.
There's all types of different tax incentives for traveling nurses. It's almost like comparing a grape to a plum or something. Like they're not apples and oranges.
Yep.
They're not comparable because, the whole way that the money is structured is different.
Yep.
But I do think that when Vermont facilities are able to recruit from out of state and they are, you know, when they have specialized needs and they're looking for the emergency room nurse,
right,
they're going to have to start competing with out-of-state salaries to recruit that nurse here. And that will ultimately, long-term, my hope is that it will start to raise everybody's salaries and benefits because of that recruitment tension.
So there's not now a commonality among wages and benefits. Do they provide a range at least to give you some guidance of what is competitive?
Sure. So during the course of the legislative process, we did talk quite a bit about the salaries in the Northeast of nurses. And Vermont is a little below other states. Mm. And it's probably a reflection of our smaller population and, you know, the strains on the healthcare system here in Vermont.
So we're going to end up the show with talking about, I'm sure there's tons of stuff now that the governor has signed this bill between now and February of 2022. What's got to be done?
Sure. So after that heavy legislative push, there's quite simply now a lot of work to be done. So our team is working, for example, with the Department of Public Safety to start to implement these finger-supported criminal background checks. And then our enforcement unit is getting ready to deal with conduct and practice complaints that may arise as we have this new system. So going back to your example of the nurse who's coming here on a compact license and working, maybe diverts some drugs from a facility, we obviously need to be able to deal with that quickly. And we need to understand what the compact allows us to do and how. So the enforcement team is adjusting to that. And then the Board of Nursing and our agency attorneys are drafting administrative rules to support the structure of the compact and guidance to licensees about the compact. We obviously have some IT changes. Our IT system is operational and up and running 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. People can apply for a license at any time and on our system. But there needs to be some system changes so that beginning on February 1st, people can apply for the compact license. So there's some IT development work that needs to be done. And then we have to train our frontline staff and our supervisory staff to be able to answer questions that come up around the compact. Some of the questions you've asked me today, they need to be competent in answering. And quite frankly, I need to become more competent in answering. So, and then probably the most important piece is outreach and engagement with the nursing community and with the facilities and employer community so that they understand what the compact allows, what the compact doesn't allow, and how to onboard new staff who may have a compact license and the benefits to the nursing community for obtaining a compact license. Yeah. So,
how long do you anticipate the turnaround? You already have a couple of weeks with the FBI background check. So once they apply, how long before you say yay or nay?
So what will happen is they will have a single state license. So let's say that you want to have a compact license. You would have a single state license, and you'd be able to work in Vermont while we're waiting for your background checks.
Because
you
don't do background checks for nurses in Vermont.
We do not. We will start now, for all nurses, whether you're getting a compact license or a single state license. We do ask people to attest under the pains of perjury what their criminal backgrounds are. But you and I know that there could be people, you know, lying there. So I do think that the criminal background check implementation is a really important public policy that we're moving this year.
Yeah, because, Lauren, you're an attorney. I just remembered, I think on applications for jobs, they have stopped asking people whether they have a criminal background check because with the assumption that they're rehabilitated and that they're going to – so would you run – are you going to run into any issues here with the nurses or because of the nature of their work?
I think it's because of the nature of their work that it's a different standard.
Yeah.
We do criminal background checks currently in the office for PI and security, for real estate appraisers, and there's another one that I'm forgetting.
Okay, I'm right with you on that. Don't worry.
So we do criminal background checks. Yeah. Osteopathic physicians.
Oh, that's interesting.
Because the physicians are part of a compact as well. And so the physician compact went through probably 2 years ago, and a requirement of the compact was a criminal background check.
Oh, so our doctors who are part of that can do exactly the same as these nurses, go, you know, Tennessee or whatever?
That is correct.
Interesting.
Yes.
Yeah, when I was in motor vehicles, I was in charge of this commercial vehicle officers and trucks in Vermont, and they have a international compact, which is very not restrictive, just lots of rules. And Very interesting when you're part of a compact.
Well, when you're part of a compact, you're giving up some of your state rights because nursing regulation is a state right. Mm-hmm. Vermont has the ability to control who's licensed here and how they operate here. And so when we're releasing some of that control, that's why the compacts get so complicated because there's a lot of contingencies that need to be settled between the states. Yeah. So that's why that bill was so complicated.
Yeah, I'm used to reading bills just because I worked in state government for so long. And I reread that thing, and I'm like, oh, my gosh. I hope I did it justice on our show because we went ahead with it. But I stayed away from certain areas because I had no clue what I was reading.
Sure.
But anyway, we're almost out of time, another 5-6 minutes. Do you have anything that you may want to talk to folks about this bill or even OPR in general? Because you do a lot of stuff.
Yeah, so I would be happy to talk about OPR in general.
Yeah, please, go right ahead.
So, you know, the Nurse Compact is one of the things that we were doing to try and reduce barriers to entry into occupied professions. We were awarded a grant in 2018 or 2019 by the U.S. Department of Labor to try and really focus on reducing barriers and for specific groups in population groups, but also in certain professions. So we are one of 16 states that were awarded this grant. It's very exciting and just a little under $500,000 that we've been using to work on significant public policy. So one thing that we did was our fast track endorsement, which went through. That was S-220. And that means that if you're licensed in another state, you can, for 3 years, then you can come to our state on a fast track basis. So again, another way that we're trying to recruit people into the state to work and live here. We have something called a second chance determination. So if you have a criminal background and you are interested in becoming a cosmetologist, you could put in a $25 application before you get any training, any skills to say, will this crime prevent me from this occupation?
Interesting.
So that someone doesn't have to invest time and money in something that they won't be able to do because their conviction prohibits them from joining the profession. And also to give them the confidence that they can invest that time and money in themselves and then it will lead to something.
That makes a lot of sense.
Thank you.
Yeah. No, it does. I actually just had a email discussion with Senator Joe Benning about that, about the cannabis bill and about people that might want to get involved in opening up a cannabis business and how having a criminal background might stop them from doing that, but as he's saying, it depends on, you know, what it was. I mean,
right, and you know. And the goal of the second chance determination is really so that somebody knows before they do that investment of time, quite frankly, usually financial investment with student loans, et cetera, that their conviction will not prohibit them from becoming a nurse. And we're trying to make it clear that we are a path forward in rehabilitation for folks, frequently a well-paying job, which most professional occupations are well-paying jobs. That's a key part in really rehabilitating yourself and making yourself part of
it. Money well spent. I like this grant.
Thank you.
This is good. Good for us and good for the feds. That's great. So I know I have to tell you about your website is excellent, as is the rest of the Secretary of State's, because I actually file. I'm a lobbyist. My friends must be turning like, what is she doing? But anyway, it's very easy to use and find information out. So I'm sure you must have a lot of stuff on the website about the about this bill in particular and how to file. And I would really encourage people to do that. I was thinking while you were talking, what does the compact office look like? Is there it's an actual office with executive director and staff that you can rely on? What
I've never seen it.
Yeah.
So in full disclosure, I don't know. My understanding is it's in Chicago, and I think they have a staff of, you know, 3 or 4 people. I think it's a lean, mean licensing machine, much like Vermont. So I really think that they're really driven on the policy and structure of the compact, and they do provide resources to us if we need them.
That's great. I hear the music in the background. Lauren, I want to thank you very much. Very interesting guest. I'm sure a lot of people now know what OPR is.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Buzzer. No, thank you very much. I appreciate it. We'll have to have you come back because I just thought of another bill that you're involved in that I'd like to chat about. But anyway, we thank you. Thank you for tuning in, folks, to this hour. We'll be back in a few minutes with our guest, Doug Hoffer, who is the Vermont Auditor of Accounts. We will be talking about dairy, about workforce development, and about a whole bunch of things of which I am very interested in, hospital price transparency, and a few other things. So stay tuned. We'll be with Doug in a minute. Thank you, Lauren.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
Hi there. It's the Vermont Viewpoint with Pat McDonald. Rick Sungar is not in studio today, and I am hosting the program. And joining me is one of my favorite elected officials, is Doug Hoffer, who's the Vermont Auditor of Account. Doug, you're with us?
Good morning, Pat. How are you?
Good morning. I'm so glad to be with you again.
My pleasure.
Yeah. Can we just tell that personal story we had going on? I went into this biker bar in Arundel, Maine, which is called Bentley's. I'm sure many of you know. And I'm sitting there, and I look across, and there's license plate number 5 from Vermont. So I took a picture of it, and I looked at the tag that said what year it was. And I went, oh, that's the Auditor of Accounts plate. So I emailed Doug, and we decided it was Alex Acebos, who was he was an auditor for a long time.
20 years.
Oh, I just amazing. He was there when I first started, and he lived in Barry, so he was well known around town. And he then, Doug, you told me, I didn't know this, that he moved to Maine, and then his granddaughter, I put this on Facebook, and his granddaughter responded to my post because somebody sent it to her, and she was so excited that we mentioned Alex. And you told me that he had moved to Maine, which I didn't know. And Bentley's apparently was one of his favorite places to hang out, which has become my favorite place to hang out.
And he gave them the license plate.
And he gets not amazing. I'm like, who did this? I've got all my license plates at home. But anyway, there you go. Thank you for being on the show. I love having Doug on. He's so knowledgeable, and he gets involved in the darndest things in his office. And I would all point you to his website, which is very interesting and very complete and easy to manage and get around. So let's talk a little bit about you first. We always like to talk about us, but go right ahead.
Well, I can give you the short version. Yeah. I'm a Flatlander. I grew up mostly in Connecticut and then lived a number of other places. But I quit high school in 1967. I didn't go to college till I was 30 in 1980 and was very fortunate to go to Williams College and then to law school. And then I came to Vermont right out of law school in the late 80s to work for then Mayor Bernie Sanders and Peter Clavel in CETO. I did that for 5 years and then went out on my own. Self-employed policy analyst for 19 years working at home, which is very much like what we all do today.
Or right. Many of us.
Then ran for the office of the state auditor in 2010, did not succeed, and ran again in 12 and did. And here I am.
Excellent. Well, we're glad you're here. You know I'm a fan. So I looked on your website and said, what are we going to talk about? And I am going to skip. I sent Doug a little list of what I wanted to talk about. I am so yanked about this. This could be a very interesting discussion. Your letter to Vermonters about the ACO. Could we jump right into that?
Sure.
Because who gets this letter? It says Dear Vermonters on it. It's on your website. But does it go out to the press? Does it go out to
newsletter? You mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, it goes to about 14 or 15,000 people, and obviously also to the media and legislators and, you know, the usual suspects. But This particular issue, as you know, I think has been of interest to people now for a number of years, the broader issue being health care, but in particular the all-payer model, which includes the Accountable Care Organization, and there's only one in Vermont at this moment, and that is One Care Vermont. And it also involves, of course, the Green Mountain Care Board, which was created kind of out of the rib of what used to be called DSHCA, which was an acronym. And
right.
That was now a smaller group called the Department of Finance and DFR. And
yep.
Out of their prior organization was created the board, which has enormous responsibility for monitoring and overseeing and regulating health care in many, many ways, particularly hospital budgets, including now the One Care Vermont. Their budget has to be approved by the board, and insurance rates, all kinds of things. It's a big deal, particularly when we spend so much money on health care. It's staggering. It's $6 billion a year. Or more by now. And we've done a number of reports in this area, in particular one with one of my early employees in the office, Andrew Stein, who now works in the tax department, on healthcare price transparency, which, as everybody knows, if you go into a hospital or to a provider and say, what would it cost if I had my knee replaced? They go, boy, I don't know. It's complicated. Not every person's the same. And there's some truth in all of that. Nevertheless, it's the most important and expensive part of your life, but you have no idea what you're going to spend. Now, 50 years ago, it wouldn't have been as big a deal as it is now because insurance covered more of those costs years ago. But over time, as people have higher and higher deductibles, we all pay more and more. And furthermore, self-insured small businesses or even some large self-insured businesses pay the full boat. It benefits everyone to know in advance what the prices are. So that was one thing that the board really hasn't done much about, which is very disappointing in my view. We've reported on that a couple times, but the first report led to a decision by the legislature, thanks in part to the fellow who's now my deputy, former Senate Pro Tem Tim Ash, who got a bill together that passed that required the two major insurance companies here in Vermont, Blue Cross Blue Shield and MVP, to develop on their websites information available to their subscribers. So if I wanted to find out, well, what would it cost for a knee replacement, and where could I get it, and how much experience do the people have who do this work, and so forth, and they did that. And we looked at it a couple of years after the bill was first enacted, and they made some progress, and I think they've made more. That doesn't mean it's done and couldn't be improved, but it's a start. Also, in Congress, remarkably, there were moments of comity, with a T, not E-D-Y, where both major parties agreed that we, collectively as consumers, need to have more information about hospital costs. So they simply told all the hospitals in America, we want your websites to include prices for what they called shoppable procedures. I think it's about 300 different procedures. And it's complicated, and in fairness, no two people are the same, but it's not inappropriate to at least have a baseline.
Mm-hmm.
So the feds required that. They were sued twice. Both cases were dismissed, I think. Maybe that's not done. Who knows? But the hospitals, many, not all, are now doing it. I think all but one or two in Vermont are doing it. So, but nobody talked about it. And I saw a piece in the Times a few weeks ago or more, and I said, well, why isn't anybody talking about it? So we decided to talk about it. And the newsletter includes links to all of the hospitals so that Vermonters can access them. And now my website includes those links. I think the board should be on top of this, and they should be educating the legislature and sharing this information with Vermonters, and they haven't yet, which is too bad. So that's basically what that particular one was about.
Now, you said this was the second, quote, audit report on the ACO. And what concerns me is you talked in this letter that the ACO model is currently scheduled to conclude in 2022, and that then there'll be a proposal, I think, from the governor to enter into a subsequent five-year agreement. But what concerned me is, as you were talking about, where the money went and how it was spent, and I don't think that's going to be available to us until potentially after the five-year agreement is signed. Did I get that right?
You did, but as it happens, something curious has occurred, and that is CMS, the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, this giant organization in Washington that handles enormous sums of money, billions, hundreds of billions of dollars. They agreed at the outset of the so-called all-payer model process to engage with a group at the University of Chicago to do some research and check on the progress of not just our ACO, but others around the country. And I didn't think we were going to see that until next year. But lo and behold, they have released a report about the ACO's efforts with regard to only Medicare.
Uh-huh.
Which in part isn't surprising because I think it's the Medicare folks at CMS that were the big movers in getting this going. But it's interesting because that story is generally positive. They, you know, I don't know whether you know how it works, but at the beginning of each year, all the parties agree to on a number of people they expect to be in the system, attributable lives, they're called, and what they expect to spend. And at the end of the year, they try to true it up and say, well, did we spend more or less? And if they spent more, then the parties have to pitch in and make up a portion of the difference. And if they spent less, then the parties get to save some of those monies and keep them. So that's the deal. But Medicare is very different than the other major part of the all-payer model, which is Medicaid, which has lost money almost every year, a lot of money.
Right.
And the subject of our second audit was to ask the question of the Green Mountain Care Board, in effect, you know, how come you guys don't count the money spent by One Care Vermont to administer this thing.
That's what got my attention.
Yeah, and it's not insignificant. You know, it's grown as the program has grown with more people in it and so forth. Their overhead, you know, was approaching $20 million before the pandemic. It's dropped a little bit since then. So we said, let's see if we can figure out the extent to which those monies, how they compare to the net of the costs or savings from the operation of the program. And the bottom line is that they didn't.
Huh.
I don't know why the Green Mountain Care Board, with the permission of CMS, admittedly doesn't include those costs because they're new costs. They're different. But in the end...
And yet somebody's paying for them, Doug.
Actually, we're paying for most
of
it. More than half of the money paid to One Care Vermont for its admin costs is paid by taxpayers.
Right. Yeah, that's what I was somewhat sarcastically saying. I mean, we're paying for this. So, and the Green Mountain Board, I heard the other day, they've really expanded their numbers. They've got a staff that's growing.
Well, they have a very substantial budget. But they also have a very substantial charge. They're asked to do a lot of things, in fairness to them. But I think to extend this just a little bit before we go on to other things, there is a lot going on right now. I understand that the state may not be asking for a five-year extension. They may be asking for maybe a two-year extension.
Oh, interesting.
The university in a recent University Medical Center at a recent budget hearing with the board alluded to what may be a new direction. They may be looking to subsume One Care into their organization, the University of Vermont Health Network, which would effectively be the end of One Care Vermont.
Right.
On the other hand, you know, and the state has also indicated that I think they're going to create their own MCO and remove the Medicaid attributable lives and do it themselves and basically administer that.
Doug, you're saying the state of Vermont's going to do that?
Yes.
Hmm.
So there's a lot of moving parts right now.
Right.
I find that really curious because this is a big deal. I'm not in a position to say what's the best next step, but for something of this magnitude and that impacts, you know, half or more of the state as of today and more as we go forward, shouldn't there be a broad public conversation about this?
Duh.
I mean, does John Brumstead, the CEO of the University of Vermont Health Network, get to decide these things?
Yeah.
What is the role of the board? What is the role of the legislature? Where's the governor? You know, everybody's busy, God knows, but I can't think of many things that are more important than health care. Certainly nothing more expensive. You know, we hear a lot of talk about the pension, the state's unfunded pension liabilities, and that's a worthwhile conversation. But every year, the state spends over $100 million for state employee health care expenses.
Yep.
That's just what
the
state pays, let alone the employee contribution.
Yep. So, or the teachers or anything else that we pay for.
Right. So, you know, where's the urgency about this? I don't see it. It's curious.
I must say I got it from reading your letter, so we'll be talking more about this. Doug, so tell me, when whoever signs this agreement, I presume the administration, for the next 5 or 2 years, it sounds like we will have financial information now.
Well, they report every year the extent to which they exceeded the costs estimated or came in under. that's why we could do the math that's mm-hmm. necessary to answer the question, are we saving money when we consider the cost of administering the program?
Right.
So we have that information. What we don't have really is good quality data, which is unfortunate because that's so essential to the larger question. Some of it is generational. You know, it makes sense to do many of the things that are under consideration or actually underway in terms of better preventive care, getting kids in sooner. All that stuff is very sensible, but you won't see the results for years, and that's okay. But there are other things that you can measure now, but they just haven't done as good a job as they would like, I think, and they're working on it, but it's hard. And by the way, one more thing about the costs from the hospitals that we have on our website and that were in the newsletter, they are radically different around the state. Mm-hmm. Thousands of dollars separate the cost for procedure A in Bennington to Waterbury or Barry, wherever the hospital is, central Vermont. And it's remarkable. I mean, people, as I said, if you have a good insurance plan and a low deductible, then it doesn't matter to you that a knee replacement costs $10,000 more at your hospital than some other, because mm-hmm. you're not paying the difference. But as a community, we are. The question is, why? And furthermore, if you, say, had a $5,000 deductible and you needed a procedure that cost $1,500 at one hospital and $4,000 at another, it really does matter. That's a lot of money to come out of people's pockets for one healthcare episode. And this information will help them make informed decisions.
I actually, when all of this was happening, the hospitals were putting out their information, I looked at all of them with my association with Campaign for Vermont, and they are radically different the way they present the information. And you talked about a hospital price transparency tool, which is now available, which could help people kind of sort through the differences in the way and the detail in the way the information is presented. I think it was Copley who just said knee transplantation, $10,000, if that's probably not the right amount, obviously, but and they didn't put all of the details down as UVM has done. So could you talk a little bit about that hospital price transparency tool?
Yeah, I think, the hospitals have done this at the insistence of the federal government. And, there are some hospitals around the country that haven't done it yet, and the question is how tough will the federal government be, and I hope they will be tough. But then there's the question, as you say, of how useful is it?
Right.
How accessible is it for lay people who aren't doctors or nurses to understand the stuff that they're giving us? And you might do better starting with your insurance company. As I said, they know your mm-hmm. policy. And they can say, well, if you were to do it this year, you've used a portion of your deductible already.
Right.
This is what's left. This is what we would pay and so forth. And also, the hospitals were supposed to, and not all have, provide information not just about what it would cost you if you didn't have insurance, but what the different rates are for those companies they negotiated rates with, like Blue Cross. And that's what caught my attention, particularly in the Times article, because that was shocking. Because they were so different, and in some cases even higher than the charges provided to people without insurance. And, you think of your insurance company, well, they're big. They're out there with me and 50,000 other people negotiating on my behalf, and they have some leverage. Well, it doesn't always work that way. And I'm mm-hmm. not talking about Vermont's Blue Cross. I'm just saying generally that the Times reported a huge variation.
Right. That is shocking. And the hospitals were supposed to present you with that information?
No, the insurance.
Oh, the insurance company. Well, that makes more sense.
The hospitals, they don't know your insurance status.
Right, because it's what your insurance company has negotiated, and you're saying it can vary dramatically.
Yes, indeed.
Right. It's really scary being without insurance these days. Period.
Oh, well, that leads to people not getting the care they need.
Right. Exactly.
And the last thing that's of interest to me, and I don't know the answer yet, is how aggressive are the parties, the hospitals in particular, and the insurance companies in telling people about this information?
Mm-hmm. Let me guess. I'm going to take a wild stab at that answer. But anyway, okay, so maybe we come back to this if we have some time. I wanted to kind of go on with what
sure.
your website had. I have to encourage people. You've got a list. You've got a list of published works and work in progress. You've got a Gantt chart, it looks like, going back from 2014 to 2021. That office has been just a little busy, Doug.
That's the idea. I wish we could do more.
Oh, my. It's amazing. I just have to add, how do you pick the issues that you deal with? Because I think there, well, first of all, this one in particular is just out there in the public. So that was sort of a, just caught right. your attention. But how do you pick some of these topics?
Well, some, as they say, are ripped from the headlines. Mm-hmm. Others, you know, it's not unreasonable to say, well, let's go where the money is.
Right, right.
Right. So we did a job in the Department of Building and General Services, which is responsible for non-transportation capital projects, you know, mm-hmm. courthouses and this and that and the other. And we wanted to know, you know, the extent to which they were getting the projects done on time and on budget, and that's a lot of money. That's mm-hmm. the state's capital budget year after year is $60 yep. to $100 million. So that was one. We also do some that don't have direct dollar impacts. For example, a fellow came to me a few years ago. I don't think he had been a legislator, but he'd been in education, and he was concerned about the extent to which the schools and the state were doing as the statute required, which is checking all new employees and those who were relicensed, like teachers, mm-hmm. and whether, in fact, their names were in the system for having these are not adult sex offenders, but people who, for any reason, were on that list that you don't want people to be on.
For sure.
And, you know, there's no dollar impact there, but he persuaded me that this is important enough. You know, if I was a parent, I'd want to know the system mm-hmm. is working. And that, you know, that the state, for its part, because they have to do teachers, they're the ones who license the teachers, but the schools themselves, when they hire a janitor, did they check that those right. people's names against the list? And to a large extent, they were, but there were some that weren't. And, I mean, it's not about the bottom line on that one. It's just about kids.
No, for sure. And that's maybe more important than the bottom line
yeah.
of dollars.
And
that's,
then, of course,
that's
healthcare
great.
Is so big, there's no ignoring it.
Yep.
And as you know, and I'm going to continue doing that as long as I'm in office. And another subject of interest to me for 30 years is economic development. So we've yep. done a number of jobs in that area. I take suggestions from anywhere.
That's great.
In fact, we've done at least one or two jobs that came about from whistleblowers. And staff makes recommendations. In fact, we just started a job that was a recommendation from a staffer, one of the senior auditors, on the state's state-owned dams, some of which are not in very good shape. And this one here also is not so much about the money, but about the risk
to human
health, and property, and the environment.
Right. Yeah, we don't need that, thank you. I think we had that was a dam here in Montpelier. We all lived through that back in about 91. You also doing one I read in the Department of Labor about workforce development performance. Well, that was a fascinating title. I was just wondering if you could explain a little bit about what that is and what's the goal of the report you're doing.
Sure. As you may know, most of the work that's done for at least publicly funded work is federal. And all states get money from the U.S. Department of Labor. And there are a number of federal statutes that direct us as to how that money is to be used and which groups and classes of people are to be assisted and so forth. And while the folks who do that within the Vermont Department of Labor do publish information every year, it's typically in response to what the feds ask for.
Doug, hold that. Can you just hold that thought? We've got to go to a hard break, so I have no choice
sure.
on this one. So this is the Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
Okay, so welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. This is Pat McDonald, your host. Joining me is Doug Hopper, who is the Vermont Auditor of Accounts. And we were in the middle of discussing a project that Doug is working on with his office. It's entitled Workforce Development Performance. And I shouldn't have asked such a complicated question a second before break, but sorry about that. But anyway, maybe you could pick up where we left off.
Yeah, most of the major workforce development programs are funded by the federal government, and they are, you know, very focused in terms of who they want the state to identify as recipients of services of one kind or another. And it includes programs for adults, low-income folks, people who are skills deficient, individuals with disabilities, veterans, and so forth. That's a big group. Also, there's a major program that's been around forever, which is basically the stuff that you can get services in one of the 12 regional offices mm-hmm. around the state if you want to put together a resume or find out about job openings and talk to somebody and get some help. Those are not deep services, but they're useful on some level. And we also have a separate program for dislocated workers, which is not a lot of folks, but those who are impacted by layoffs. And then a program that the state cares a lot about that focuses on youth, kids who are either out of school and not working right. or looking to get some skills. And we were interested in a number of issues, you know, how these costs break down per participant, how the state's efforts compare in terms of costs and outcomes to other states. In theory, maybe whether the state could get a waiver from the federal government and do things a little differently, which some states do, and we never have for reasons that we will learn about. So, it, you know, it's complicated, but this is a difficult time for the labor market. People are having trouble finding workers. There are lots of people who want to work and aren't working for a variety of reasons, and I think that's going to be a problem as long as the,
right.
The pandemic continues. A lot of folks don't want to go back to the workplace. But, you know, and folks have skills in one part of the state, but the job's in another part of the state. You can't just pick up your kids and your family and move, you know, overnight. So there's a lot of variables here. So I just thought it was an interesting time to look at the state's efforts in this regard and take a look at their performance.
Interesting. Well, having been the Commissioner of Labor a while
Indeed.
Back,
yes.
yeah, I merged the Department of Employment and Training with the Department of Labor and Industry, and that became the Department of Labor. And they are a great group of folks. You hit upon something, though, Doug, that will be very interesting. When the pandemic is over and we're all feeling comfortable and going back, what work will really look like? Because you're right, I like working at home, and you obviously do too. And I heard from, I have to double check this, but I heard from that businesses are seeing much more productivity. First of all, you don't have to travel for an hour back and forth. And here in Vermont, a lot of people travel. And, you just are your home, and so you want to work, and you wind up working more, bigger, better. And it'd be interesting to see what this place looks like after the pandemic.
So I agree, and I think it's not too early for interested parties, legislators, program managers, employers, and workers themselves to come together and begin
yep.
to flesh this out.
Yep.
Because there's going to be some lessons learned, and it will have a huge impact on so many aspects of the economy, particularly commercial real estate, among
other
things.
Oh, yes. Yeah, you can just name everything. We're doing a lot. My co-partner and I, a co-host and I, Ben Kinsley, we're doing a lot of stuff by Skype, by Teams, by whatever the live stream base is, and don't go into the studio very often. We just do it at home, and all you have to do is look good from the waist up. What a deal!
Right, you can wear sweats.
Yeah, exactly, and I have done that, and no shoes. But I was thinking when you were talking about the Department of Labor that they, I'm assuming, are starting to think about the new workforce ahead of us, that they've got to kind of make some changes on how they're training people and getting the word out about, and there are jobs available everywhere, may I say. I said this in the earlier program that I did. We traveled back from Maine a lot in the summer, and there are signs, you know, jobs opening, willing to train. It's they're out there if people want to work.
Yeah, I think, you know, everybody wants to work. The question is, do they want to work in the public eye
right.
and face-to-face?
Yeah, yeah, and that's...
And a lot of the jobs that you're referring to that are available require that.
Yeah.
That's a tough one.
Well, and there's a lot of benefits from working face-to-face and with your neighbor, but there's also some good stuff about working home. But anyway, we digress. So when will that – when do you think that project will be ended and there'll be a report put out?
We're pretty close, actually. We are reviewing – it's probably not the final draft, but pretty close
cool.
to it.
I'd be anxious to see that one.
You will.
You had one that I, because I love agriculture in Vermont, and I follow it, and of course we have a great Secretary of Agriculture, Ensign Tebbets. You put out a report about state spending for the support and environmental mitigation in the dairy industry, and you said we've spent more than $285 million on the dairy industry. And what I found fascinating, and I've heard this before, that even though we are losing our farms, which is very sad, our dairy farms, that we are actually doubling, we've doubled our milk production, I'm assuming because of technology, that we have less cows, but better ways to collect the product.
Actually, the number of cows hasn't changed that much.
Really?
But the number and size of farms definitely has. Now the majority of cows are on very, very large.
Oh, I see. Okay. That actually makes more sense to me.
And there are efficiencies to be gained from those large operations. On the other hand, they may or may not be the best way to try to get a handle on phosphorus in our waterways.
And that's the runoff issue, correct? I mean, that's what...
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right. And furthermore, although I don't know the extent to which small traditional Vermont dairy farms were as important to the local, truly local economy as we might like to believe, but if you have, you know, a farm with thousands of cows, chances are they're not buying much from the local hardware mm-hmm. store. Oh, wait, the local hardware store is gone.
Yeah.
Right? So right. I think the impact on the state economy is very different than it was 50 years ago. And, you know, there's a lot of people in farming, dairy as well, that are aging out, and their kids don't want to work that hard.
Right.
Or at least work that hard on that particular occupation or yeah. that field. So, and the state, to its credit, thanks to a group of people that advised Madeline Cunin back in the 80s when they created the Vermont Housing and Conservation Trust
mm-hmm.
and came up with a remarkably clever and almost painless way to pay for it, but they have conserved hundreds of thousands of acres of farmland and forest land that cannot be developed. So we're halfway to at least one kind of a solution to the problem for retiring dairy farmers, in many cases, if their farms have already benefited from that program. But the other side, as you know, is the enormous cost of mitigating the
right.
environmental impact.
Right.
And that's only going to go up.
Yeah.
We have
Doug,
to do it. We have no choice.
Let's hold up on talking about that for just a second. I have Jackie from Cabot on the phone to talk to us. Jackie, welcome to the show.
Hey, Pat. Thanks. Thanks for letting me call in. I just wanted to make a comment in regards to Auditor Hoffer. I don't think it is correct that just because a farm is larger and the local hardware store has gone out of business that their money is not being spent in this state. The dairy industry puts a lot of their money back into the local companies that are still around. We buy a lot of our feed and the equipment. You know, these farms of all sizes support the local equipment dealers so that other kinds of farms can have access to those same people. So I disagree wholeheartedly with the comment that we are not putting our money back into the local economy. It definitely, a lot of it, if not most of it, goes in there. And the point about spending more and more money on the mitigation of phosphorus going into the lakes, you know, that program has been very, very successful. Farmers have stepped up and have worked very hard to do whatever they can on their farms with the help of the federal and the state government, of course. And it's been very successful. We have decreased our phosphorus load into the lakes tremendously. And I have a real challenge when I hear the fact that we are getting grants to do this. I would love to have somebody give grants to the cities that are polluting the lakes when they have sewage overflow. But you don't hear about that happening, although I do have to say I think maybe Montpelier or Rutland is getting some of the ARPA money that's coming in to do just that.
Good.
But, you know, the issue is if Vermont wants to look like Vermont and if Vermont wants to have tourists come in and they want to have beautiful farmland open, conserved or not, we have to support the dairy industry, which supports the state, and I just like to make those comments. I'm very proud of what our dairy industry has done as far as mitigating phosphorus, maintaining the countryside and being open so that our guests can come up and see the countryside. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Jackie, and thank you for the work you do. They just gave me your first name, but I know who you are. And I know you work very hard in support of our agriculture here in Vermont, so thanks. Doug, do you have any comments for Jackie? I do say that I think our farmers, they really do understand the importance of our land and making sure it remains healthy.
I never said otherwise.
Oh, yeah, for sure. No, I know that. No.
But we did an audit a couple of years ago on a major program in the Department of Agriculture, now Agency of Agriculture, called the Best Management Practices, and they did not have the information on the effectiveness of most of those investments mm-hmm. on the farms. So that's one. The other is, as to her concern about money being diverted for other purposes, as it turns out, when we did the job on looking at how the state had spent the first $100 million on lake cleanup, a significant portion of it, the largest portion of it, went to wastewater treatment plants in St. Albans, in Rutland, and Waterbury. Now, that's not to say that those towns didn't need that work done, but those were the least cost-effective ways of removing phosphorus from the lake because very little of the phosphorus goes through those plants. So it's incredibly complicated. There's a lot of politics.
Yes.
And I can appreciate why Jackie is concerned about my comments, but all we do is report the facts.
Yeah. Yeah, I was going to mention that early on. I think most of your audits are just the facts, as they used to say on an old police show on radio. Just the facts, ma'am, because you don't give necessarily recommendations or what you might look at as a solutions. You just present the facts and let folks.
Well, no, we do make a lot of recommendations, and we track the extent to which over time state entities have adopted our recommendations. And
oh,
we do
good.
Very well.
Oh, well, there you go. Doug, can we pick up on that discussion? Because that's been around for a long time.
Oh, indeed. Decades, if not more. And, you know, it's a big challenge. We can't ignore the lake. It's so important to the state's economy and because it has its own value as an environmental resource, not just for human use. But it can't be ignored, although successive state governments did for many years until it was a lawsuit that forced them to do this.
Right.
And they haven't really yet figured out how they're going to pay for it over 20 years, but they've made a good start. They've spent quite a bit of money already and more to come. And they are trying to address some of the issues we raised about how those funds are allocated and whether they are directed to the methods best able to remove phosphorus or prevent it from getting to the lake. So I think we made a difference on that one for sure. We got their attention. Mm-hmm.
So I need to go back a little bit. I misspoke that you don't provide recommendations, but you do. And why I hadn't thought that, because I read most of your stuff. I find it fascinating that the work and the detail of the work that you do. You track whether they follow you or not, or whether they respond or not.
Indeed, yeah. We look 1 year out and then 3 years out.
Oh, interesting.
The difference is that most of our resources are devoted to what are called GAGAS audits, audits done to generally accepted government audit standards, and they are very detailed. An outsider would say tedious, but they provide the kind of security that somebody in my position needs. There is, in truth, not one word in any of those audit reports that hasn't been referenced to a source.
Yep. Yep.
A document, an interview, and so forth. So, you know, I have tremendous comfort when I release them, when I share our findings and conclusions with legislators and with the public, that these reports are rock solid. Now, when I took office in early 2013, there was one position in the office that was under my predecessor had been used for communications. I repurposed that position to an investigative analyst,
mm-hmm.
and that position has produced some of the most interesting work we've done during the term. They're a little more flexible than the GAGAS work because you don't have to meet all those technical standards. Having said that, as a researcher myself for, you know, 30 years, I care tremendously about the facts. And those things are done just as rigorously as the GAGAS audits, but we don't have to have all the paperwork necessarily behind it. So that's why you see two major pages on the website. One is audit reports, the other is investigative reports. And they're both fun. And now we, as a rule, don't offer recommendations in the investigative reports, but we have conclusions and suggestions to the audit team.
Now, and I know you're up in the legislature a lot, and I certainly hope they listen because, as you said, you are just presenting the facts. So it's right there in black and white.
Indeed.
It's frustrating, isn't it, sometimes? They hear things, but they really need to look at the facts. That would be good. I need to just clarify one thing. The $285 million I spoke about was actually spent, not in 1 year, was spent between 2010 to 2019. So I just wanted to make sure we got that. Sadly, it should be spent in 1 year because there's lots to do. The runoff leads to Lake Champlain, and I haven't heard much about what's up with Lake Champlain. Have you tracked that by any chance? I mean, are we getting better? Because at one point, the EPA was threatening to come in and take over the cleanup for us. So is the work that's happening on the farms and as Jackie pointed out, our municipalities, are they is it helping the lake much? Have you heard?
Well, that's what we did a report on a couple of years ago, which was an evaluation of the first tranche, as it were, of almost $100 million, most of which went towards Lake Champlain and not meant for Magog or the Connecticut River.
Mm-hmm.
And we basically broke down how the money was spent, how much of it went to municipalities for wastewater treatment plants, which, as I said, is not a great way to get rid of phosphorus. Also, natural causes like roads that erode.
Right.
Allow phosphorus to run, and not just phosphorus, but other things as well, pesticides, herbicides, all kinds of stuff. And the extent to which wetlands were being protected, improved, enhanced, and so forth, there's a lot of pieces and parts, and also investments on the farm, and much of that comes from that ag program called Best Management Practices,
mm-hmm.
which is a weird one because they use capital funds, which are almost exclusively spent on state and public land.
That's interesting for sure.
To give a private party money to make an investment on their own land. So it was different. It caught our attention. Anyway, the state, after our report, I think they probably would have done this anyway, they changed direction a little bit, and it was all top-down from before that time. Now they've created a system where the regional folks have a lot more input into how the money is used, and I think it's a little premature to say, you know, what are the results of that, but we may look at it again down the road.
That's great. And you mentioned that the other investigators do a little bit different investigating with not so much regulations. What were some of the things that they identified for you as things we should be knowledgeable of?
Oh, you mean the reports?
Yeah, right.
Oh, we've had some great stuff. For example, there was one early on about non-competitive contracts for services for the state. Referred to as source contracts.
I know that.
For 100 years in this country.
Right.
Public entities are supposed to go out to bid.
Right.
And we found that a huge percentage of the contracts were not bid, which is too bad. I think that really made a difference. That got people's attention.
Yep.
We've done quite a bit of work on healthcare on the non-audit side, on both sides for that one. I've done some work on my own on economic development on that side. I also did an interesting job on state and local spending on public safety. Everything, correction, state police, the attorney general, defender general, all of it, and found that in 2017 it was $574 million for public safety in a state with 630,000 people.
Whoa.
Yeah, that got my attention.
Gee. Sorry, I don't know how to respond. What the heck?
Well, my response is that system developed naturally, like it evolved. It's not the result of a strategic plan meant to be cost-effective.
I think it's
likely that there's a lot of redundancy and inefficiency in the system. And I keep mentioning it to the legislature. I say, isn't it time that you step back and took a fresh look at the whole system?
Yep.
All of it.
Yeah, well, welcome. I mean, of course, we have, just for transparency, my sister, Susan Zeller, was the first performance czar in state government. She's just retired. But there's a lot of work to be done.
Oh, there's no end. Oh, give her my regards. I didn't know she retired.
She did. She's actually loving it, although she misses the people, but as we all do. But she found a lot. I mean, just so much stuff, as you said. You could just pick a department, and because we've always done it that way. And there you go. So, Doug, we just have a few minutes. I have to thank you very much for being on the show. I would encourage people to check out. Oh, and they can also sign up for your newsletter, which is where the hospital price transparency tool information was just presented.